listening to CJSF and 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours, sharing music and voices from genres and cultures around the world, reflecting you and the rest of your community. You make CJSF diverse.
Do you like music, or do you like technology, or do you like talking to people? CJSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CJSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show, and tons more. To find out more information, visit cjsf.ca.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we report from the federal budget media lockup on Press Progress sources, explore the bizarre pop culture of the far right on Bubble Pop, explain why we need to cut our American technology dependence on Tech Won't Save Us, and develop a new parenting system to overcome the historical tension between fathers and sons on Seriously Wrong. First, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at Unrigged.ca. Since launching in October 2022, Sources has provided in-depth interviews with experts and newsmakers across the country from the award-winning journalists at Press Progress. On this excerpt from a new episode, Canadian Labour Congress senior economist D.T. Cochran joins Press Progress editor Luc Lebrun live inside the federal budget media lockup to share his first impressions on the Carney government's first budget. Now, here's the show.
This week, Mark Carney introduced his first budget since becoming prime minister. Carney's finance minister, François-Philippe Champagne, is billing it as a quote-unquote investment budget. But in addition to billions in new spending on major infrastructure projects, the budget also outlines $60 billion in cuts, including the elimination of 40,000 jobs in the federal public service. What should Canadian workers think about Carney's first budget? My name is Luc Lebrun, and I'm the editor of Press Progress. Today on Sources, I'm live inside the federal budget media lockup with D.T. Cochran, senior economist at the Canadian Labour Congress. We're going to get D.T.'s real-time reaction to what's inside the budget and what this all means for Canadian workers. We're recording this week's episode of Sources live from inside the budget media lockup, deep inside the bowels of the John Diefenbaker building in Ottawa. This is Ottawa's former City Hall. It currently houses offices for Global Affairs Canada. And for today, at least, it is where nearly every journalist and economist in Canada has been locked up. So we can all sift through Mark Carney's first budget with a fine-tooth comb. D.T., you're the senior economist with the Canadian Labour Congress, which is the umbrella organization for Canada's labour movement, representing 3 million workers and labour unions across Canada. Looking at this budget from a labor perspective, what's your initial reaction to budget 2025?
This budget was disappointing, to say the least. Expectations were extremely low, with some hope that we were going to see significant investments in sectors of the economy that would employ workers who need to be employed. We need to see more jobs in the trades, more jobs associated with residential housing construction, for example. There have been these nation-building projects that have been announced, and we hope to see more in the way of that kind of investment. But we also knew that significant cuts were going to be made to the public service, and we were fearful of what exactly those cuts were going to look like. The cuts we feared are indeed going to be implemented with far less clarity on what exactly that will look like. So a lot of very abstract claims about finding efficiencies and streamlining operations, what exactly that will entail still very much remains to be seen. And then on the investment side, this government keeps talking about how this is an investment budget, and they are doing an extreme disservice to the definition of that word.
I'm glad you brought up investment, because François-Philippe Champagne has been repeatedly referring to this as an investment budget. But this budget's also announcing $60 billion in cuts. So is this really an investment budget, or can we call it an austerity budget instead?
This is very much an austerity budget. The government's expenditures are expected to increase, but the biggest expenditures that we're going to see over the next year are largely tax cuts. This is the exact same game that federal governments have been playing for decades. That made it extremely Orwellian to hear Finance Minister Champagne refer to this budget as a game changer. All the Carney government is doing is trying to reframe the same things that Liberal and Conservative governments have been doing year after year as though it's some brand new thing. They talked about how the global economy has changed, the relationship with the United States has changed, and so this is requiring a change in how the government operates, but they just keep doing the exact same things.
So Mark Carney's government also announced a comprehensive expenditure review earlier this year that asked federal departments to find ways to cut 15% of spending over 3 years. DT, can you help listeners understand how Carney's spending review works and what this budget tells us about how the Carney government is going to go about making those cuts?
There's no formal definition for what a comprehensive spending review actually entails. So trying to understand what departments will do in order to cut their spending requires a detailed explanation for each department. And the budget includes a department-by-department breakdown for the size of the cuts that are expected. But then the descriptions of those cuts, as I mentioned earlier, offer no clarity whatsoever. Every budget for years has said that the government is going to find revenue through supposed efficiencies, but there's been no follow-through to explain how that's been accomplished. So one more exercise of claiming that efficiencies are going to achieve this 15% cut is worrisome, because we should expect to see large losses of jobs, but it's also laughable because finding efficiencies, streamlining, these are slogans. These are not actually things that get achieved. So we should still expect to see the loss of programs, the loss of jobs, and government services that people depend on getting worse.
So just in case listeners are wondering, we're actually sitting in the middle of the media lockup room. So if we're speaking with a bit of a whisper in our voice, that's because Robert Fife is standing right across from us right now. And we're trying very carefully not to distract all the hardworking journalists in this room as they are busy preparing to file their stories. DT, we're currently here in Ottawa, and Mark Carney's home riding is in the suburban Ottawa riding of Nepean. And as one could imagine, the Federal Public Service is a major employer in this city. Carney's budget is announcing plans to eliminate 10% of positions in the Federal Public Service over the next 3 years, which would work out to about 40,000 jobs by 2028. Now, the government says some of these positions will be eliminated by, quote, normal attrition through things like retirement and, quote, voluntary departures. But nonetheless, this is an elimination of a substantial number of jobs. The Canadian Labour Congress obviously represents a number of public sector unions. I'm wondering, what have you been hearing from those public sector unions about their concerns in terms of what this is going to mean for public servants and communities that are supported by these jobs.
Even if the jobs that are eliminated come strictly through attrition, that is extremely worrisome. We have an economy that is growing more complex. We have an aging population. We have proliferating and mounting environmental crises. We have more security threats. There are all kinds of challenges that are coming our way that demand a robust public service to be able to offer the necessary response. So each time there is attrition, meaning someone leaves the public service and then no one is hired to fill that job, the tasks that that person performed don't go away. That just means they get piled onto the remaining workforce or they simply don't get done. So all we're going to get is a less effective, less efficient government. We're not going to get a more efficient government. We've been promised more efficient governments through cuts for years and years and years, and we have never achieved that because the politicians in charge from Chrétien to Harper and now Carney, they fundamentally misunderstand the relationship between the public and the private sector. The private sector depends on a robust, accountable, effective public sector that provides goods and services that the private sector simply will not provide. So the attempt to improve the economy by allowing the public service to shrink is, quite frankly, shooting ourselves in the foot. It's going to take us further in the wrong direction. We're going to spend more years trying to fight back from a shortfall that Carney will have imposed upon us after years of previous shortfalls from the repeated attempt to shrink the federal government that doesn't succeed but does make the government less effective.
So at the same time as the Carney government is conducting this comprehensive expenditure review, they're also spending tens of billions of dollars on infrastructure projects or so-called nation-building projects that are in the quote-unquote national interest. DT, what do we know about these projects and what stands out to you about how money is being earmarked for these specific projects?
There is spending that's going towards these projects, but most of the supposed investment spending that the federal government is committed to is going to be delivered through other kinds of mechanisms that it claims will attract more private sector investment. It makes the quite frankly laughable claim that it is going to attract $1 trillion in private sector investment. The reason this is laughable is that a lack of investment is because of a huge amount of uncertainty within our economy, and simply offering new, bigger, faster tax breaks is not going to address that fundamental uncertainty. Offering tax credits is what governments have been doing for years, and all we have wound up with is less investment, slower productivity growth, more precarious jobs, slower wage growth. We have not got the promised benefits. I don't know when we will stop behaving like Charlie Brown being offered the football by Lucy and told that this time she won't pull it away. It has been pulled away every time, and it will be pulled away once again, this time by the Carney government.
So on the topic of tax measures, federal budgets have traditionally been the time of year when we learn about various boutique tax credits that are being aimed at different stakeholders or voting groups. Was there anything like that that appeared in this budget? And what pops out to you when it comes to tax policy in this year's budget?
The main things that jumped out to me in terms of tax policy were that the biggest expenditures since the fall economic statement are the Carney government's rollback of planned changes to the capital gains inclusion rate. So this starts to get a little bit wonky to explain in detail, but those changes were going to bring in $5 to $5.5 billion a year. By rolling back those changes, The Carney government is handing that money directly to the wealthiest Canadians. These are the people who would have been paying that tax. And by not making this change, they're leaving the wealthiest people, the people who need assistance the least, they're leaving those billions of dollars in their hands, where then they can get mobilized to engage in lobbying of the federal government to try to prevent the exact kinds of changes that they don't want, which don't benefit the rest of us. They never have. The promise has always been held out that, you know, lower capital gains taxes are going to induce investment, but it just does not happen. It's starting to really feel like Groundhog's Day, that despite the massive threats that we're facing, we're still being told that the same kinds of policies are going to this time do something different.
Since this spring's election, Mark Carney has faced criticism from progressives for campaigning one way and then immediately governing a different way. We saw this, for example, with the way Carney used a lot of nationalistic elbows up rhetoric during the election campaign and then quickly shifted to a more conciliatory tone with U.S. President Donald Trump. Similarly, you know, looking at this budget, how would you say what's been announced today in this budget measures up with what voters heard Carney talk about on the campaign trail?
We were told that Canada was going to get a robust government response designed to protect Canadians, designed to fundamentally transform our economic system to become less dependent on the United States. Back when the free trade agreements were first being negotiated, labor groups, progressives, warned that there would be serious negative consequences from these trade agreements. And that is exactly what has come to pass. Despite the fact that the people who warned what was going to happen turned out to be right, those people still aren't being listened to. Some of the rhetoric that Carney adopted might have seemed like it was lifted from these folks talking about creating more national resilience, talking about being more independent of our extremely large neighbor to the south. But what has Carney done since being elected prime minister? He's done the exact same thing as every other prime minister since the 1980s, whose misguided economic policies got us into this current situation. He's done the same thing, he's doing the same thing, but telling us that this time it'll be different. Trust me, I'm an economist.
In addition to that, overall, what should be the main takeaway about what Mark Carney's first budget will mean for Canadian workers and their communities?
This government can't be trusted to look out for Canadians. Their biggest expenditures are giveaways to the wealthiest. At best, they're sincere believers that these giveaways will produce investment in the economy. But simply looking at the facts of how tax cuts in the past have changed the economy, those changes have not been in the interest of Canadian workers and their families and communities. And nothing in this budget indicates that the Carney government will be any different from those previous governments. It's just going to be at least another year after this budget that we continue to move in the wrong direction while the world around us changes and makes our economic situation more dire.
DT, thanks so much for joining me on this week's episode of Sources Live from the Media Lockup for the 2025 federal budget.
Thank you for having me, Luke.
I've been speaking with Canadian Labour Congress senior economist DT Cochrane. You can follow DT on Blue Sky at dtcochrane.bsky.social. Sources is a podcast by Press Progress, and it's edited by the multi-talented Eric Wickham. If you like this podcast, you can find more of what we do at pressprogress.ca, and please subscribe to our podcast. Press Progress is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. You can check out other great Canadian progressive podcasts just like this one at harbingermedianetwork.com. My name is Luke LeBrun, and I am the editor of Press Progress. You can follow me on Blue Sky at lukelebrun.ca. Thanks for listening.
There's an excerpt from a new episode of Press Progress Sources. Find out more at pressprogress.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Every week since February 2025, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist, Rachel Gilmore, has been breaking down the main headlines so you don't have to doom scroll on Bubble Pop. On this highlight from a new episode, Canada Research Chair in Digital Extremism Amy Mack and the Institute for Strategic Dialogue's Amarnath Amarasingham joined the show to talk about his new book, Contemporary Far-Right Culture, The Art, Music, and Everyday Practices of Violent Extremism, in a conversation unpacking far-right culture today from tradwife, influencers, and Christgram to far-right fiction and fashwave. Now, here's Rachel.
Hello, I'm Rachel Gilmore, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist. Welcome to Bubble Pop, the spooky show, get it? Because it's Halloween today, where we talk about some of the scariest headlines and ghoulish news tidbits so you don't have to doom scroll. And for season two, you guys know this by now, we are doing it live. So just a reminder that if you want to support the show, you can do so on Patreon, Substack, Twitch, YouTube, as well as anywhere you like to listen. And while we're live, you can use the super chat function on YouTube to ask a question that, provided it's appropriate, I will take at the end of the show or ask to my guests. So because it is Halloween, I've got an episode straight out of your nightmares ready today, because there's nothing scarier than a true story. And today we're breaking down something terrifyingly cringe: far-right culture. See, there are actually semi-secret ways that these guys signal to each other that they're part of the far right, some more obvious than others. They also have their own in-groups, jokes, or in-group jokes, art, music, and day-to-day practices. So saying or doing a lot of this stuff does not inherently mean that you're far right. But if you're part of the far right, you're probably saying or doing some of this stuff. Luckily, we've got a Rosetta Stone here to translate it all. A new book was just published called Contemporary Far-Right Culture, The Art, Music, and Everyday Practices of Violent Extremism. And I got my grubby little paws on it. It's a fascinating read that tells you all about the actual culture of the far right today, from the QAnon group chats to tradwife influencers to Christgram, far-right fiction, and fashwave. Who better to help us dig into all of this than one of the men who edited this new book and another top expert on the far right? Amarnath Amarasingham is one of the country's top experts on extremism. He's an associate professor at Queen's University and is a senior research fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Our other iconic expert voice is Amy Mack. She's a Canada Research Chair in Digital Extremism, an assistant professor in new media at the University of Lethbridge, and she's co-director of the research at the Canadian Institute for Far-Right Studies. I am extremely, unreasonably stoked for this conversation. So, Amar, Amy, welcome to Bubble Pop.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for being here. I'm so happy to be talking about all of this. It's very spooky stuff. The first thing I have to ask you, because I think about this every time, what is up with all the Nordic shit?
So, I mean, that's a good question, because like modern far-right paganism, I guess, has its root. It goes back a long ways to European like folkish counterculture, and this idea that kind of Aryans were a divine beings fallen from the golden age. And it's been slowly over time linked. Religious identity, spirituality has been linked to racial identity. And so race has become this kind of spiritual inheritance, or it's a kind of biological inheritance for these people. And so what that means is Christianity is often seen as a kind of Jewish conspiracy theory that was meant to kind of pacify Europeans, destroy their warrior spirit. And this is where a few interesting ideas come into play. I know you covered the conference in Vancouver that was a couple months ago now, and so one of the speakers of that at that conference talks often about this idea of metagenetics, which is a fancy way of saying spirituality is actually hereditary. And so it's your spiritual identity is engraved in your DNA, and it has been buried by you know, name your out-group here, Jewish conspiracies, whatnot, has been buried over the years and can be reawoken, right? And so you can do certain rituals, you can be in touch with nature, you can engage in warrior-like activities, i.e. active clubs, to reawaken this buried DNA, spiritual DNA, and bring it to the fore, right? And so what they try to do, I mean, to go to your question, is they try to find a pre-Christian Aryan religion that they can attach themselves to, because they believe that that part of themselves has been taken away and actively buried by conspiratorial, you know, spooky forces.
Wow. Amy, do you have anything to add to that about all of the Nordic obsession?
Yeah, and I think I'll take it away a little bit from the sort of spiritual component of the Nordic sort of perception there, to think about how Canada as a nation state has also always been obsessed with sort of the Nordic stock, right? Like if we look at how immigration was framed in like 1910 and the late 1800s, it was about trying to get folks from, you know, Northwestern Europe to emigrate to Canada, because there was this perception that there was a genetic superiority to those folks, right? They were from these harsh climates, they were rugged, they were well suited to survive in these sorts of places. And so I think that sort of historical context that shapes how oftentimes the far right talks about immigration mixes really or meshes really well with that sort of Nordic spirituality. So I guess what I'm trying to say here is that it makes sense that that sort of rhetoric would be in places like Canada, because we've kind of been talking about aspects of this for a very, very long time, right?
Oh, that's so interesting. I didn't know that. And I think that's one of the things that's so cool about this book that, Amar, you just put together with Marc André. It's such an interesting idea to look at not just, I think that when we talk about these groups, we often talk about the sorts of threats they pose, or maybe some of the organizing tactics and demonstrations or propaganda, things like that. But to actually genuinely look at the culture of these groups is so fascinating. What made you want to put this together, Amar?
So there was a book a couple of years ago put together by Thomas Heghammer, who wrote the foreword to this book as well, thankfully. It was called Jihadi Culture, right? And that was kind of his argument there, is that we have an overwhelming focus in terrorism studies and extremism studies on ideology, on politics, on tactics, on death count, on all of these kinds of things. And we forget that these are people who have cultural aesthetic dimensions to why they're involved in these sorts of movements. And so he had chapters in that book on poetry, on, you know, devotional songs, on dreams, on the importance of dreams for jihadist movements, on weeping, the idea of weeping as witness, right, as why you're part of this group, and so on. And so we wanted to kind of, not that it hasn't been done before in the far right, but we wanted to kind of look at how some of that stuff plays out in the far right movements, you know, publishing houses, what are the aesthetics, what are the podcasts, all these kinds of things in terms of how the far right actually goes about its life day to day, as opposed to just focusing on, you know, death counts and attacks and tactics and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I find it really interesting to you as a means of understanding how people get sort of radicalized into these movements and sort of the pathways and areas of benign interest that kind of have this overlap, right? Amy, I actually was just listening this morning to a new propaganda video released by what the Canadian Anti-Hate Network just listed as, you know, Canada's top or largest white nationalist network. And one thing that struck me was, you know, in these public facing moments, how they sort of tamp down their rhetoric to try to appeal to these broader audiences. Is that an intentional tactic? And how often do you see that from these groups?
Yeah, I think we really saw that begin with the alt-right, right? Like that was a very tech-savvy movement. That was a movement that was really concerned with, as you say, optics. They want to be taken seriously. And this is an aesthetic shift from perhaps when we think about what the far right looks like, you know, sort of like the biker aesthetic, the big beards, the tattoos, those sorts of things. I think there was a real sense that these folks had baggage associated with their aesthetic, and if they wanted to be taken seriously by the mainstream, because I do think on some level this is a political project that is trying to make inroads into the mainstream, regular folks need to take them seriously. We see that a lot in other ways. My work is in Alberta, so right now we're seeing sort of a move away from visible protests and rallies and more towards infiltrating municipal governments and school boards. And it's because this is seen as a more PR-friendly way of approaching far-right goals and policies and just general movement, goals. So
yeah,
I would say it's increasingly common. Yeah.
Interesting. You know, one thing I also found kind of interesting was, you know, as I was reading this book, Amar,